The Ebola crisis in West Africa and the ongoing combat operations against ISIS could hollow out the nation's military forces. Jim Carafano, Vice President of the Catherine and Shelby Cullum David Institute for National Security and Foreign Policy at the Heritage Foundation, has three recommendations to keep the military from declining in capability as demands increase. Jim, it's great to talk to you as always, my friend. Thanks for coming on the program. What exactly, before we get to the three items, is your definition of hollowing out the military? Thanks for being on today.
But that is a great question. You know, in my lifetime, and I include my dad's service during the Korean War, since if he hadn't come back, I wouldn't be here. I've been through kind of four hollow militaries, the hollowing out after World War II, running up to the Korean War, Vietnam, really the sad state of the military in the 1990s, where we were really declining very quickly after the end of the Cold War, and then kind of the current that we're in. And what I describe it as, a hollow force means things might look fun on paper, but you can't actually execute. And that could come from not having trained and ready forces, not having the money, the resources, whether it's equipment to do current operations, and not preparing for the next conflict for the future. So sometimes folks can prop up one. Matter of fact, now some of the services are throwing a lot of money in training, and they say, "Look, everything's fine," but they're raiding the modernization counts, infrastructure, other things to pay for that. So it might look okay from one perspective, but unless you can do all three things: trained and ready forces, do current operations, prepare for the future, you are not a fully capable force that can support American interests.
The chiefs have been pretty vocal as they go to the Hill at any opportunity and go just about any place else at any opportunity and talk about readiness, about the fact that the budget cuts the Pentagon's undergoing is impacting readiness now. There was a time where they were projecting readiness problems in the future, and that tune has changed to reflect the issues that they're seeing in the force today. What is your sense of the reason that that message may not be printing on Congress in particular?
Well, in part because, in some aspects of the force, readiness is actually going up. Matter of fact, we just run the numbers on some of the things, and in some cases, readiness is going better. But what you really do have to look beneath the numbers, and that's why it's a very confusing situation, because all the services are approaching readiness differently. The Army, for example, is putting a lot of emphasis on their brigade combat teams. Those are the lead combat units that go out. But they're really compromising on readiness for the rest of the force, which is a problem. The Air Force has really kind of taken cutbacks in readiness, and because they're trying to save money for the modernization accounts, the Navy somewhere in between. The Marines have thrown everything against readiness, but they've really compromised on everything else. So not only do we actually have readiness challenges, we have different approaches to readiness among the services. And why that's a problem is they all kind of fight as a joint force. So it's like having a car, but with bad brakes, but you got gas in the tank, but no steering wheel. I mean, unless everything's working at the same level, you could have real challenges.
All right, your latest commentary is Three Steps to Avoiding a Hollow Military, and we have a link to it at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. The first item you write about is the services need to improve readiness across the board. You've addressed that to some degree. How important is that? It sounds like that integration, the parity that you're talking about there is the most important element of readiness that the services are not able to do right now.
I think that's right. And again, I think this is a 2016 issue. I mean, I think the budget's pretty much locked for 2015. It is what it is. I think in 2016, though, there is, I would say, a general recognition that defense spending isn't right. And of course, we all want it to be more efficient. We want to cut out things that are wasteful and reprogram that money to things that are valuable, but that takes time. So the first thing you do is you make sure everybody has enough money for readiness so the force as a whole can respond if it needs. So that's definitely priority one.
You gave me your definition of readiness. Does everyone have the same definition, and do the services even agree on what they need to be able to do to complement each other? I'm just, for example, does the Navy understand and agree on what it wants the Army to be able to do and the Air Force to be able to do to complement its power projection?
Yeah, I mean, they do, but it's really, really complicated. So, for example, the Army is really the backbone of the entire force. I mean, we say, well, power projection in the Pacific. Well, that's the Air Force and the Navy. But if you look at the joint war plans, oftentimes the service that's providing a lot of the logistical backbone in the theater is the Army. So you're right. The services have to be worried just not only about their own readiness, but about the capability of other services to support them. And there really isn't a theater where it's like, we don't need those other guys. If you think for example, even in Iraq and Afghanistan, which were primarily army fights, was a huge requirement for ISR, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, put a very heavy strain on the other services. And we were borrowing actually manpower from the other services for truck drivers, doctors, all kinds of things.
The second item on your list, Jim, is to stop the ground forces cuts. And that, this is obviously music to General Odierno's ears that he has an advocate for that. But it's not just in the Army's case here, I imagine, either.
Well, I mean, I think the Marines, too. I mean, I think optimally in a perfect world, I think about 200. I'm just talking active, not reserve, because the reserves are also important, but 200 active Marine, about 500, 550 active Army would be, I think, adequate. And the reason for that is, and that's a strategic choice, because we're talking about losing capability, losing capacity to do things, and you can't buy it all back at the same time, and you can't do everything. So the question is, well, why would you say, well, let's keep the Army capability first? And the reason for that is it's the quickest, right? I can keep troops a lot faster than I can add another aircraft carrier, or I can add another wing of F-35s. And I can do something valuable with that resource. I can stick that in Western Europe. And why that's very important is an increased ground presence in Western Europe sends a very powerful message both to the Russians, and it's sitting right over the Middle East and Afghanistan. And so the bad guys will always, even though, you know, President Obama says no boots on the ground, they're always going to have to watch warily if there's an American military presence, you know, sitting over there that can be deployed against them. So I think there's real strategic advantage to, you know, make sure ground power is good and then put it in Western Europe where it really can keep the other guys on their toes.
One of the greatest deterrents to having to put boots on the ground, an Army officer told me once, was knowing that those boots are there, that our opponent knows that the boots are there and could go on the ground if we needed them to.
I think it's that's a good example. I mean, I think it's a good comment. I mean, if you look at Korea, for example, I mean, can we prove that the American ground presence in Korea has helped keep peace for decades? Well, I guess the only way we could do is taking them away and see if there's a war. But I think it's generally recognized that the U.S. ground presence in South Korea, which has not fought a battle since the end of the Korean War, has been an enormous force for stability in that part of the world.
Jim Carafano of the Heritage Foundation writing Three Steps to Avoid a Hollow Military, publishing originally in Politico. And the third on your list is stop making the Pentagon trim programs to acquire essential major equipment. What are some examples that you're thinking about here, Jim?
Well, I mean, you could be talking about F-35s, tankers, ships, I mean, submarines. And the point is what really makes defense really, really expensive, in part, is this whipsaw in what we do in modernization. We throw money at a program, and then we starve it. And then we throw money at it, and we starve it. And if you sustain investment over time, you create predictability in the services. You also create predictability in the suppliers. And we build some trust and confidence in the system that we're going to buy things at a responsible rate. And I do think putting some money in the modernization accounts to demonstrate that the big ticket items, the ones that we're going to have to buy and continue to buy for years to come, that the train is going to kind of run on time. I think that would be really helpful. I think it would send industry a good sign. I mean, we've got to send the defense industrial base signals that we're going to buy stuff in the future. Otherwise, they're going to go away, and we're not going to have a just-in-time defense industry. If a lot of these companies go away and then we want to buy something, it'll take us years to crank the production line back up. We, Tomahawk missiles is a good example. We said, well, we're not going to buy anymore, and then we deplete the inventory. Well, if you do that, you're not buying anymore, and then you say, well, now I need to buy things. You have to recreate the industry to buy that. It's going to be more expensive and much more time-consuming.
Unpredictability and uncertainty are the two words that I hear the most when I ask contractors, not just in the defense space, but all across government, what drives up your cost, what makes the government pay more, Jim?
Yeah, and I'm saying let's put some money to calm the defense sector down thinking that your business is going to evaporate, or you're going to have to go through 7 years of lean and, you know, 7 years of fat. You know, let's keep the production lines going.
Part of that, though, does require a decision-making process inside the Pentagon where you make sure that you're striking the right balance between buying enough to keep a line going and buying stuff you don't need just to keep a line going.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And you know, a lot of people say, well, let's just starve the Pentagon, because what that'll do is that will force efficiencies, and then people will they'll really buy the things they really need. Well, if only that were true. I mean, and we've seen this even in the private sector. Sometimes when you starve a company in the private sector, they go out of business. Sometimes they do make, you know, decisions that find new and more profitable way to do things. But, you know, we've got to be reasonable. We want to put pressure on the Pentagon to be as efficient as possible and to make smart choices. But at the same time, we need to make sure they have sufficient capacity and capability to defend the national interest. I think there's going to be a common consensus in Washington that we can't square that circle. We can't do all those things unless we, in a sense, you know, recognize that we are in the basement in terms of building the future military, and we stop that. I think that's a 2016 answer or a 2016 problem to kind of build the foundation for the future. And I think it's going to have to start with a fully funded, responsible defense budget that goes through a regular order and gets passed. And it has not at the sequester levels, you know, the levels that we're required to cut to, but at a fully funded level that lets them put a little more money against readiness, some money to keep the production lines going, and then, you know, money to kind of keep the ground forces at a higher level and put them where they're strategically important.
Just a couple of minutes left, Jim. Is the quadrennial defense review that's in place now and some of the other policy documents that exist, are they good markers or guides or frameworks that we can use for this kind of planning that you're suggesting?
No, I think it's why they recognize in the defense community that kind of real strategic requirements planning stopped in like 2010. And everything that the Pentagon has put out since then has really been a budget drill to justify a lower number. The only document that I think has any credibility is the National Defense Plan, or the National Defense Panel that put out their report this summer, which I think is it's a bipartisan, nonpartisan panel. I think it is a clean, independent look from the Pentagon, and I think it reaffirms what they said in the previous National Defense Panel 4 years before, that this is not a sustainable track that we're on. And I think that the recommendations that I make, I think, are actually very consistent with what the NDP said for how do we kind of stabilize where we are.